see the amplitude of that AC and the frequency. I think that'd be an interesting test.
I agree. And there's a couple of things I'd recommend. If you take a battery that you know is in fairly poor condition, and you make a measurement with your oscilloscope as to peak-to-peak voltage and frequency, and as the battery restoration process proceeds over X number of days, I'd be very curious to see if the peak-to-peak AC voltage decreases. I am predicting it might decrease, and the frequency might also decrease, because as the battery becomes restored and more of the active area of the plate is doing its job, I am guessing the equivalent capacitance of the battery starts skyrocketing in microfarads or farads, and that the equivalent series resistance starts going down to smaller and smaller milliohms. Therefore, the circuit that's doing the restoration, which is current limited in both its AC component and DC component, I'm guessing that the AC ripple you'll sense will go down and the frequency will go down. That's a pure guess on my part. But as you run that experiment, I think we're going to find out a lot. I think you had a series of questions you wanted to ask, John, maybe even about magnetics. So let's give a quick call first to see if Paul is back. WS2N, are you on frequency? Do you have your ears on, as they used to say, Paul? KQLIW in the deckhead.
WS2N, yes, I'm hearing. Very good story about the battery reminder topic. Ready to go, Dick.
We're ready. Go right ahead, Paul. And after that, I'm going to go back to John because I think he's got a series of questions. You got it, Paul.
Okay, very good. We've been talking about Curiosity and all the other Mars missions that have gone there in recent, around the last 10 years or so. And a lot of people think that that's the end, you know, no planned missions. There is one planned mission coming up. It's due to launch next year, around this time, November. And that's called the MAVEN mission. It's the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution mission. It's a orbital mission, no lander. But this thing is planned to test the atmosphere. High quality instruments, eight different types of testing equipment on board. This thing's going to dip into the atmosphere around 90 miles above the surface and then go out to a high elliptical orbit, maybe 4,000 miles out, and not quite a polar inclination, but around 70 degrees when we drop it. And this thing's going to really test the atmosphere on what's going on with it. With this planet, with the magnetosphere, and you know what kind of history it's had. Where did the atmosphere go? They really can't say conclusively on what happened to the atmosphere. They know it doesn't have a magnetosphere like we have, but they are going to test for. There is some magnetism here and there, but to protect the atmosphere, there's no ozone layer. But yet, at the same time, at the surface, they don't have high radiation, which is what they really expected, in the environment. So here's this other mission that's going to be going up, and it'll actually go into orbit early in 2014. This is WS-1. Interesting that it's not going to be really a jet propulsion type of control launch. It's coming out of a Goddard Space Center. They're really involved with this one. So I thought I'd bring that up. Not much tonight, but one other quick topic on the Space Launch System they call the SLS by NASA. That's the NASA manned flight missions that they have for the future. The earliest you'll see a manned flight would probably be 2017 or 2018. And this thing is, the rocket that they're building is going to be bigger than the Saturn V that took the astronauts to the moon. They have different technologies that are going to be going into this, including this one process that they have for building, like, you know, all these very intricate piping details with the engines and a lot of other things. It's called the SLM, or Selective Laser Melting System. Throw it on the internet, on the net. Let me drop it. And what this is really, it's a laser system that melts metal, you know, in an enclosed environment, and essentially it's a 3D printer, like a 3D metallic printer system. So you program that you want this series of pipes to come out a certain way, certain different bolts and this and that, no welding involved, and you could have all these intricate designs, and this thing will come up from the bottom of the surface where all this powder is, and it'll come up, and you know, inside of a small period of time, you'll have this pump-looking piping type of a ring that comes out of nowhere, and then they blow the dust away, and here it is, with no welds on it, just like one continuous unit. So it'll bring the core. They used to have the idea that some of these metallic piping arrangements would cost, you know, a fortune, maybe years to put together and weld and all. And you know, with this system, you could do it in days. So, interesting development with the SLM. I never saw anything like this before, Dick. Back to you, WS2N.
And once again, Paul, where is the SLM going to be used? Is this being developed for 3D printing, so to speak, on the surface of the Earth? Or is this a piece of space hardware that will be doing welding in space? Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, I thought about it. I mean, eventually you could have this in deep space, say a part broke and you wanted to duplicate something like this, but that, you know, maybe that's, you know, 50 years down the road or 100 years down the road. But no, this is a, instead of developing a complicated piping scheme, you know, spending countless days or months or maybe even a year developing a, you know, intricate piping, this comes out in, you know, inside of days, you know, maybe even less, in this enclosed machine. So it's on Earth, and let's say you needed a wide connection with maybe three or four connections coming off of it, and they have to be, you know, very smooth, and, you know, for a flow of fuel that has to go through. And, you know, that might take forever to do conventionally. This thing, you put it into a computer, and here this thing comes out. You know, it heats up metal with the lasers, and this thing comes out perfect. They had a video on the NASA site, a very small one, maybe the size of a pen. You know, for the one that they showed, they didn't say how large they could go with these things, but apparently, I mean, it's ready to go. I mean, whoever developed this, it's working. You know, it's an actual thing. It's not even, you know, you could put these pieces into production right now. Back to there.
Sounds like an awful nice piece of hardware. I forget which website I wandered into like a day or so ago, but I eventually ended up going to a NASA website that talked about the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, which was launched a couple of years ago, and it has been mapping where the gamma ray bursts are taking place in the universe. good common sense would lead you to believe the gamma ray bursts would be aligned with the galaxy and the Milky Way that we're part of, and they're not. You look at that three-dimensional map of where these gamma ray bursts are occurring, and the particular map they present has got about 150 gamma ray bursts being plotted, and they're all over the place. And what is a gamma ray burst? Let me drop the word. It is, in theory, the most violent events that we know of. As I've said so often, whenever you put into space any kind of a telescope-like machine that's looking for stronger and stronger amounts of burst energy, as you use the thing, you'll always find something that saturates your telescope. In other words, no matter what you plan for in the number of electron volts of energy of a particular burst, Mother Nature is in that space, in outer space, producing events that are way beyond your anticipation. The photons that are hitting your eye right now in your room are 1 or 2 electron volts of energy on each photon. These gamma ray bursts that are being measured by the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope are numbers like 300 million electron volts. We think the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland is a really big, really powerful, expensive machine. Mother Nature is creating gamma ray bursts that are way beyond the amount of energy that we're ever going to get out of the LHC. These are hydrogen and helium nuclei, among other things, moving toward the Earth at ridiculously high relativistic speeds. It's very close to the speed of light. And boy, they pack a hell of a lot of energy. The good news is there's not very many of them. The bad news is that they are really potent. And you can speculate, let me drop, as to what are you looking at here? Are you looking at stars crashing into each other? Are you looking at neutron stars crashing into each other? Are you looking at the neutron stars and white dwarfs? Or are you looking at the black holes and neutron stars crashing? Are you looking at a pair of black holes crashing into each other? You can only make a wild guess as to how much energy. It's a rare event, but do black holes hit each other? It's inevitable. It looks like the center of every galaxy has got a supermassive black hole. Millions of, there are single stars, black hole-like stars, in the middle of almost every galaxy that have many millions of solar masses eating up anything that comes nearby. And maybe that's what really holds the galaxy together. And you've got these gamma ray bubbles coming off the top and the bottom of the center of each of these galaxies, these bubbles of squirted out energy, squirted out particles. A lot more to find out as to what's going on. You can easily say the amount of unknown knowledge is a lot greater than the amount of known knowledge. Nobody set up this universe to be nice and simple for mankind to understand. There's a couple of mysteries out there. Do you think there's a couple of mysteries out there, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, we do have a lot of telescopes looking at it. You got the Swift telescope. When they get a message from, let's say, any one of the Earth-bound telescopes or even Hubble, that there's a gamma ray burst or something, these things turn immediately and start recording that information. So not only do you have single telescopes, you have telescopes working in tandem with each other, including the yet-to-be James Webb telescope, very expensive, way over budget. That thing will sit out 1 million miles away from Earth and do its work probably in the year 2018. So about 6 years from now, that thing is scheduled to be launched. Taking a lot of money away from the other programs. Talking about the Mars programs before, we were supposed to be signed up with European Space Agency on a Mars project, but they had to let that go because of the James Webb was taking money away from a lot of these programs. We were going to launch a rocket, and on that rocket would have been a European Space Agency robot. your space agency to eventually send this rover to Mars. And they have a couple of other planned Mars missions as well. Also a couple of planetary missions. They want to send a lander to one of the moons of Jupiter. They'd like to have a land on Ganymede, one of the four Galilean moons. So, I mean, we've got missions planned. The Russians still have planned missions. Even India, well, India was going to use their own rocket to launch a vehicle, you know, a lander to the moon, but now they're involved with Russia. They're going to do that for them. So you've got different countries and now different private companies involved in the, you know, planetary missions. Let me drop it. SpaceX even wants to use their rocket. They have a heavy lift Falcon rocket they want to send to Mars. You know, pick up the slack. It's unbelievable. It's not good enough for them to just send cargo missions to the International Space Station. SpaceX wants to, they actually already have private contracts signed with other people for private launches, orbital launches. And they won't even want to use their heavy lift Falcon rocket to send robotic equipment to Mars. So it should be pretty interesting in the next 10, 20 years what goes on in the space race for all these different companies and countries that are involved, including the telescopes. I can't count how many telescopes up there. In almost every different frequency that you mentioned, it's countless. I looked through it one time. There's got to be at least 10 active telescopes, space telescopes, that are working that our country is involved in. You know, solar telescopes. Incredible. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
There's been a couple of NOVA programs done by Public Broadcasting System talking about the age of the telescope or the way telescopes have changed our perspective, our view of the universe and the way we fit into it. Telescopes have given us a tremendous amount of information. I only own an 8-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope. It's a modern-day standard, some medium size, for privately owned. I got some friends that have got some 11s and 14s and 18s. I got a friend who owns a 31-inch diameter telescope that he built with his own hands twice, because the first time he built the mirror, it cracked and he had to do it again. 31-inch diameter. This telescope, in order to look through the eyepiece, it's a Newtonian-like telescope with a Dobson mount to it. You have to stand on this A-frame ladder about 12 feet in the air to look through the eyepiece. We make a joke about the fact that when we look at John's telescope, you have to wear a parachute to come back down after looking through his telescope. But boy, does that thing give you images. Wow. So there are telescopes and there are telescopes. And when you use some of these portable-like telescopes, like my 8-inch, with the right kind of erecting mirrors that you can use it for looking at terrestrial objects, I get a great kick out of standing 150 feet away from my 100-foot-high tower, looking at the top of the tower with that telescope. With the right eyepiece, I can decide what things I want to repair next. Is that particular cable broken? Is that antenna got a bent element and so on? What tools do I have to carry up there with me? I look at it with the telescope first. Let me drop. I can have a slant range distance of nearly 200 feet away from the top of the tower. And if I put the right eyepiece into that telescope and focus it correctly, I can take a quarter 20 bolt, that is, let's say, the end of the bolt is 2 inches long, and I can make that bolt fill up the whole screen of what I see from 200 feet away. I can count the threads on that bolt. Or 150 yards away, somebody put a little business card tucked into the door of my neighbor across the street, and I could look through my thermal pane windows at the front of my house and read that card from 150 yards away. I could read the fine print. I could only do it when a car was not passing on the street in between us, because each car passing by would create a heat wave that made the air flutter around for the next 60 seconds. But it's amazing what telescopes can do. They're kind of fun. And I guess if I was so motivated, I could be looking into people's windows. Can you imagine taking a telescope like that, mounted on the top of the tower with an Azel good set of precision motors, so you could look down at all your neighbors at a 45-degree angle? You could get yourself into a whole lot of trouble. But being able to see things with high resolution because you're about to do a repair can be very handy. You know what tools to bring with you. Let me drop it. There's one other thing I think we should be discussing with reference to safety. From time to time, I get a little bit angry at media. By media, I mean newspapers, radio, and television combined. That news, we used to think it's news. To those organizations, it's really entertainment, because it attracts a whole lot of people watching it, and therefore it sells a whole lot of advertising. And back in the days when the FCC used to require that a broadcast station must prove each time the license is being renewed that they really served the community, that they supplied what people needed as well as what they wanted. The FCC used to require that. For reasons I don't understand, they dropped that requirement. And now there are some skeptical people who will say that they make this funny comment, if it bleeds, it leads. In other words, if something really damaging and terrible is happening, and it's part of the news, people will watch it. Well, I'm a little bit unhappy that a given piece of information that's vital is not being given. As we look at more and more news reports of the terrible situations that took place during Hurricane Sandy, quite a number of people appear to have drowned. Let me drop it. And because there's so darn many of them, and then there's a belief that 120 people who drowned washed up on the shore of Staten Island, and not all of them have been identified. And did they come from New Jersey, from Manhattan, from Brooklyn, or from Staten Island? We don't know. Because there's so darn many of them, identifying them is so difficult, I guarantee very few, if any of them, are undergoing a reasonable autopsy to try to find out what happened. And even if you did do an autopsy, you'd probably find water in the lungs and you would say they drowned. Overly simplistic. It is my belief that a high percentage of those drownings was an uninformed person making a poor decision, that had they been given the right information, they would have not made the poor decision and they would have survived. Here's what I'm talking about. You decide to stay with your house because, Hurricane Irene was kind of minor compared to all the predictions as to how bad it was going to be, so you say, I'm going to ride it out. So you're in your house, and pretty soon you realize water is pouring into your basement, and you never thought that would happen. And you suddenly realize, well, my child's baby book is down there, and Aunt So-and-so's pictures are down there. I'm going to go down and rescue them. Wow. Is that a poor decision? Done with a lack of knowledge. That water that's pouring into your basement probably is at 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And if it's a very short period of time you're going to spend in that water before you're going to get hypothermia. And when you start getting hypothermia, all of a sudden the muscles don't work anymore. And you can't do anything. That's the minor one. If any of that seawater pouring into your basement touches any piece of electrical equipment, if there's a plug in the wall for the washing machine, and the plug snakes itself down to the basement floor and then up to the washing machine, and there's a little frayed section of that cord, and it's electrified, and the water touches that. If any of that seawater touches anything that is electrically activated, and your body is in that water, and if you're 30 feet away from that event or less, the electrical potential that exists across that water can so easily electrocute you. It is my belief that a high percentage of those drownings were electrocution. In either case, the person dies. he's unable to do anything rational while the current is flowing through his body. He can't move his muscles correctly, and he eventually ends up drowning and sucking in water. So even doing a thorough autopsy to try to find out was it electrocution that preceded the drowning is a darn interesting thing. But how many people really know the last thing you want to do is enter the water,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
The last thing you want to do is to enter the water that's pouring into your basement, to enter the water that's pouring into the first room of your house, to be in the water inside of a house that has electricity still flowing. For you to be in that water, and if any of that water touches any electrical outlet or any bare piece of wire, electrical appliance, your life is at huge risk. How many people know that? I'm very unhappy that they don't know that, that they haven't been told that. This is one of three major events in the last 20 years where a lack of knowledge is causing a lot of misery and unneeded deaths. The other two are the 5,000 people that died during the heat wave of 30 or so years ago in the Midwest. They died because of a lack of very simple knowledge as to how to control a hyperthermia situation. Very simple techniques could keep those people alive. 5,000 people died over a couple of months period, over a couple of states, because it was spread out in time and spread out in states. It never appeared in the news, and the missing information was never given to those people. Another event is the crash of Flight 587, right after 9/11, that airline from Dominican Republic with 260 people on board, and they all died because those pilots were not properly informed about the wake that occurs behind a very heavy airplane. A 750,000-pound Japan Airlines 747 Heavy, 750,000-pound, that airplane took off first, left a huge wake behind it, and in a too short a period of time, the next guy took off, the Dominican Republic plane, Flight 587, and the wake he encountered did terrible things to that airplane. And the final accident report, let me drop it. The final accident report that came out of that blamed him for using over-rudder control. To a degree, that is true. But that wasn't the initiating event. That was three steps downrange. The first step is an extremely heavy airplane took off. The second step is he took off in too short a period of time right behind it. The third step is he flew the exact same path directly behind that airplane, guaranteeing that he's going to encounter those wakes. And what does that wake look like? In order for that airplane to create 750,000 pounds of lift, the heavy airplane, it was pushing air downward violently like you wouldn't believe. Well, the two wingtips of that airplane were two extremely violent horizontal cyclones. Your eye doesn't see it, but they're there. And when they hit the rudder of your plane, particularly a damaged airplane as it was, it's going to rip the rudder off the airplane, and after that, it's game over. The pilot wasn't given the right flight instruction. And 260 people on the airplane died, and something like five people on the ground died. Needless. Well, here we are with this Hurricane Sandy event, and how many people know how dangerous it is to enter the water in any portion of your house when there's anything electrified in the vicinity? How many people know that? How many people should know that? Why isn't the media spreading that word? As you can tell, I'm a little hot under the collar on this one. A lot of needless deaths took place, and they're being blamed on the wrong thing. They're being blamed on simple drowning. Yeah, the drowning took place, but that's one or two steps downrange of the original event. Anybody got any comments on all of the above? Give me your call letters right now and your name, K2RIW.
GV, with a quick comment.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, it's a great point you brought up, but you also have to realize downed wires and puddles, basically the same problem. They mention it once in a while, but that's something that should really be emphasized, and then connect that to the same thing in the basement. So many people, even when you see a wire sparking on the ground, you see it hit asphalt, say, now, if it's a high voltage line, it starts to burn a hole in it. People don't know how dangerous that is, and media's not doing their job.
The hot wire, the electrified wire dancing on the ground, touching a puddle, into that puddle, it's bad. But you put your whole body, 1, 2, 3, or 4 feet of depth of water, you put your whole body into that body of water of your basement in order to recover what you think is a valuable object. I'm convinced, John, that that is 10 dB worse. In the case of stepping into a puddle, you're going to feel that tingle through your feet. There's going to be a lot more than a tingle, but there's a good chance you'll survive that one. You enter that water of a couple of feet of depth in your basement, and it suddenly touches a outlet. I think that's at least 10 dB worse. Nobody in his right mind should go into a room of a house or into a basement where water is pouring in. No matter what is down there, I don't care if it's it's 5 pounds of gold or platinum, it ain't worth the life. Into XJN, K2RW, go ahead, Wes.
Kind of confusion here. In terms of the high voltage dropping on the ground, you have a step voltage. Understandable. But in terms of the water, at first, we have to assume that we have the electricity in the house, and then the water is stepped in, and now somebody is immersing himself in the water. The point is that water, especially dirty water, is a good conductor. And a person is at some point at one potential only. Also, the second thing is that the shortage of the line makes that line disabled. Just from practical point of view, the bird on the high voltage line is still alive. And to here.
A comment on that, Dick.
Hey, go ahead, John.
Wesley, what you have to realize that Dick is talking about, in the basement, there are current paths, even though the outlet is flooded. Maybe 3 feet away, there's a boiler, or maybe 10 feet away. There's a current path there. Not enough to blow the circuit breaker, just like the water around the outlet. Now, when the human, who basically dries like 7,000 ohms, soaking wet, he goes into that current path, he's going to be conducting electricity. That's part of the problem. And there are multiple paths all over the basement. So that's how it's happening. That's basically what my experience tells me.
Let me respond to that. Okay, imagine that to be a coil or just a resistor. So you have a 20 feet between the outlet and you have a console. And now we have a person. Now, could you measure if you have a resistor with 133 winds and measure what is the voltage between T3 and T4 wind? That's going to kill it. It is not going to kill it. And to FGM.
It's not a live thing. When your body carries current, it does damage. Dick, over to you.
If something in the vicinity of 100 milliamps flows from your left hand to your right hand, you're at the threshold of being sent into fibrillation and going into the equivalent of cardiac arrest. When your whole body is in this highly conductive seawater volumetric resistive material, the amount of voltage from your left hand to your right hand required is an extremely small number. It might be only a couple of volts. Under normal circumstances, I can put my fingers across 28 volts. There are lots of circuits that you can install, like rotators for antennas and whatever, outside the house, where the maximum voltage is 28 volts, and it is considered safe by normal standards. In other words, with my fingers touching the 28-volt terminals, I'm probably not going to die. You give me 28 volts with a large enough conductive pad between my left hand and my right hand, I probably can kill you with 10 volts. If I took a conductive salve pad and I put it on your left temple and another one on your right temple, and I put 10 volts between the two, I'll probably kill you. If the conductive path is grounded by various water pipes, conductive paths through the cinder block wall and whatever. You can easily have 120 volts applied to the water and 10 feet away it's being grounded. 120 volts across 10 feet is 12 volts per foot. And I spread my hands out, I can get lots of voltage from hand to hand in an extremely conductive fluid that's making extremely good conduction to my body. It can get you. N2XJN, KQRIW.
All difference of potential.
And a very small difference of potential will kill you if the ohms of contact are small enough. Salt water, a highly conductive fluid, touching every single square inch of the body portions that are below the surface. Is that a conductive path to a large enough area, giving you enough current capability that can be launched into your body across that resistive volumetric material called salt water?
Okay, let me respond to that. Electric resistivity or electric resistance is volume of resistivity quantifies how strongly a given material opposes the flow of electric current. And the low resistivity indicates the material that greatly allows movement of the electric charge. So now we have a salt water, and the salt water, the resistivity is, I'm trying to find what is in here, but it's a quite conductive. 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter cube. I'm trying, not having it right now in front of my eyes, but it looks like the body of the man is standing, and the volume of the man, comparing to the distance, let's say 20 feet, like jump, is like a parallel connected.
KIW.
It's like parallel connected resistors. Now, the resistance of the water versus the resistance of the body is like 1 ohm resistor versus the body, 100 ohm resistance. Similarly to that example. Now, how much current is gonna flow to the resistor that is more in resistance? If we were talking about the resistance, we can talk also about the impedance, but then we have a summary factors in here. My understanding is, yes, it is dangerous, but at the same time, I'm going to kill it. And to see it.
But you're standing on a wet concrete floor, which is conductive, Wesley. Dick, over to you.
That's a different story. I'm talking about person being submerged in the water because he is hunting for the bracelet of his grandmother. That's what I'm talking about. And to agree.
Stand by. You guys are not letting the machine return. Jim has been trying to break in. VE3JIW. Go right ahead, Jim. K2RIW.
VE3JIW. I think you said milliamps. Did you not mean to say microamps? I think it's 50 to 100 microamps to kill, but interesting discussion. By the way, if you wire on the ground in a puddle, you have to do slow step shuffle to cross that puddle. A big step can give you a big potential between your two legs, so it's a small step shuffle through a puddle. I don't think that works in deep water. KQRIW, VE3JIW.
Loss in regards to the high voltage on the ground and the step current. A step voltage does not apply to the water. Don't do it.
Okay, Wesley seems to think it's safe. Wesley, if I want something to be recovered from my basement when salt water is pouring in and the house is still electrified, are you going to volunteer to go in my basement and retract that object for me?
That's a good point. Thank you, Dick. Here's the point. We were talking with John about 20 feet distance. We were talking about the volume of the body in vertical position, and we're talking about the resistance of the water, not talking about the impedance. The resistance of the salt water in relation to the sewer, pretty conductive. I was restoring a TV and a computer and a small TV also from the salt water in my lab, and I was taking some of the measurements. Anyhow, the body with its value, vertical position, compared to the salt water, is like 1 ohm resistor to 100 ohm resistor. Now calculate the volume and the current for a distance of 20 feet. It's safe. And do it again.
I strongly disagree with that statement. There's a lot more going on here than has been made obvious. Are you trying to say by your analysis, Wes, that essentially all of those drownings, none of them were electrocution? Is that what you're trying to say?
No. I never said and never made this statement. Just typical logic, Dick. You have a vertically standing person. How wide is the person? 2 feet. You have a 20-foot distance. You have a flowing current. Now, if we take it as a resistor, 133 winds. I am a 33rd and 34th wind, if any. Now, put your voltmeter on it, between 33rd and 34th wind, and find out how much voltage is there out of 120 volts. What is it? Just take your calculator. And now, calculate the current. And do it here.
I'm going to ask you a very direct question, Wes. I've got a large metal pan of salt water. I've got a pair of them. Your left arm is inside of the water of the left hand metal pan of salt water, and your whole arm is in that. Your right arm is in the other pan of salt water, a metal pan of salt water, and your whole arm is in it. And I've got two wires connected to those two metal pans. How many volts should I put between those two pans before you get into a whole lot of trouble? N2XJN, K2LIW.
Depends the distance. It's like you're putting yourself in a horizontal position now. You represent 10 winds out of 133 winds. Now the total voltage across from the tip of your finger to the tip of your toe is much larger. You're trying to find a certain scenario. What I'm saying is, in the theoretical scenario of discussed with John, we have, what, 10 volts? Maybe 7 volts that is flowing through the person. Now, the current is across the resistor. Find out what is the current. It's like you're connecting parallel to the resistor, 133 winds. In 33 winds and 34 winds, you connect a person here as a resistor, but this resistor is much larger than the resistance represented by 33rd and 34th wind. And it's simply shorting. I've been there. And to again.
It didn't answer the question. I'm going to ask it a different way. Your whole forearm on the left side is in a pan of salt water, a metal enclosed pan of salt water. Your right-hand forearm is all in a metal pan filled with salt water. Both of your arms are completely under the salt water. Tell me how many ohms I'm going to measure between those two metal pans, where the only thing in between them is N2XJN. How many ohms am I going to measure between the left-hand pan and the right-hand pan? Tell me an approximate number of ohms I will measure. Answer that question.
It's going to be approximately about 2 to 3 kilo-ohms, but it's going to be deadly current because I am not submerged in the water. My left arm is in the pan, right arm is in the pan, and the current is flowing through one pan to the second one. I'm going to be dead. Enter here.
The first question is how many volts, and you haven't answered that one. The second question is, you said a couple of kilo-ohms. Guarantee that number is extremely high. The number of conducting paths I have between the square foot of area of the skin of my left-hand forearm, all under seawater, conductive seawater. I got roughly a square foot of area of skin, and all of that skin has some number of ohms connection to the blood supply that's in those veins and in those arteries. And those veins and arteries with that blood is a highly saline conductive solution. You think I'm going to measure a couple of kilo-ohms between those two pans between your two arms. Guarantee your number is very high. I know that John wants to make a comment on this. KC2WGB, K2LRW. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, Dick, real quick. When you're walking on the basement floor and you get in between that current path, it's going to take the path of least resistance, which is going to be you soaking wet. That's where the deadly current is going to come from. Back to you, Dick.
There's lots of situations where a lightning bolt struck the ground. It struck the ground 100 feet away from a bunch of cattle in the field. The cattle that were pointed in the direction of where the lightning bolt struck, because of the voltage gradient that took place across the ground between the front feet and the back feet of that cow, and he died. There's a number of those cases that have happened. That ground, you and I think, is a very good conductor. Well, if I measured it in ohms per square, ohms per square centimeter, you would come up with a pretty high number. You think ground is not very conductive. But the way that those voltage lines of potential spread out from that point of contact of the lightning bolt, the way they spread out in a circular pattern, and depending on whether the cows are aimed toward the lightning bolt or sideways to it, is part of the function as to whether or not they get electrocuted. And that ground is nowhere near as conductive as seawater. You put a human being in seawater with any electricity touching that seawater, and that person's in an awful lot of risk. The area of the seawater contacting that person is huge. The number of people who have died standing with just their ankles in seawater at the side of a seashore with their rowboat upside down and a metal-cased drill motor in the old days in their hand with a circular sanding disc on the end of it, and they think they're going to sand their boat in that condition. They're going to take away some of those barnacles. You'd be amazed how many people used to die before they double-insulated drill motors with a plastic package on the outside. There's just your ankles in the seawater, touching the metal case with one hand on that drill motor. And if that drill motor is improperly wired, it's game over. You don't want to play with this stuff. Seawater and electric...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
No matter what's in that basement, let me drop it.
AIW.
Jim recognized, no matter what's in that basement, it's not worth the risk. When seawater is pouring into your house, they've got to be out of the floors that have the seawater. It's not even safe to be in the second floor of the house because as the water starts rising, if you haven't got a place to go, if you crawl out of a window and the house is still electrified, I'm not sure that that's safe. Let's hear what Jim's got to say on all this. VE3JIW, K2RIW.
I just know I looked up the number of swimming pool deaths caused by broken lights in swimming pools. A large number. Google that, and I think there's the answer. Water and electricity and salt water kills.
The pool water, Jim, is essentially fresh water with some what are we putting now? Chlorine in it. The water in your swimming pool, in your backyard, probably has 10 times higher resistance than seawater. So ordinary water in a swimming pool with improperly wired lighting in that swimming pool kills a significant number of people per year. Can you imagine how many more people would be dying if the water in your swimming pool was salt water? Now back to you on that one, Jim.
Hey, very good.
Real close to you in 7-3 for tonight. Let that somebody else take it. I don't have much comment now. Back to Ned.
You got it, Eric.
I just wanted to point out that lights in swimming pools run on 12 volts AC. Just wanted to point that out. K2J.
Certainly, running on 12 volts is a hell of a lot safer. Do you believe that by the lights running on 12 volts instead of 120, do you believe that that essentially removes this as a danger? Certainly, it lowers the danger by an order of magnitude. But is there still no electrocution danger, even at 12 volts? What do you think, Eric? K2EJ? K2RIW?
No, 12 volts can still be nasty. Depends upon conductivity. If you have a pacemaker or some types of devices that have external contacts that lead to internal to the body, it could be a problem. But for the most part, 12 volts, and by the way, chlorine is, you can consider it sodium hypochlorite, which is sort of an electrolyte, so it does improve conductivity of the water. But for the most part, it's deemed safe, but I can see circumstances where it's not.
Yeah, I know. Let me check on this last one, Eric. Do you believe all swimming pools with lighting these days to be up to code must be 12 volts or lower? In other words, to your knowledge, you could not get an approval for the design of a swimming pool that has higher than 12 volts to its lights that are touching the water. Over to you, Eric.
Well, as far as I know, that's been code for like the last 30 or 40 years. So, if you go to a pool supply place and you ask them for a light bulb for your swimming pool, you're going to find it's either a 6 or a 12 volt bulb.
Makes some sense. Okay, we've only got a minute or so left. This was TechNet number 4126 of the series that began in September of 1982. We haven't settled all these issues, and yet there's some controversy here and some differences of opinion, and we'll eventually come up with a better answer. I'm still concerned that a significant number of those people died from not just pure, what's the word for it, drowning. I think they died from electrocution. That's an opinion. It's going to be very difficult to confirm because we don't have proper autopsies that would detect that difference. Be kind to each other. 73 you all. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW and KC2WGB. John, say a couple words.
Did you get the probe I sent you?
I sure did. Well done. Thank you. And I'm about to apply it. That's another whole interesting little, what's the word for it now, mystery that I solved to some degree.
You might want to sleeve that with a little spaghetti tubing or something, because it's quite long, and make a little point on the end if you want. That's what I do on some testing.
Thank you. You started the TechNet with you from height.
For my particular application, John, I needed that extra length for my particular application, so thank goodness it is that long. You did the right thing, John.
Okay, Dick. My pleasure. KC2WGB.
Thank you, Dick, very much for being with us, and very interesting discussion.
Bye-bye, you all. Do try to be kind to each other.
I was just puzzled, John, that information about what Dick said, ground, I think, radio communication.
You cut out in a bit of that, Wes. What was that?
Your operation.
Yeah, he made a...
VE3ZZ2 is flying to VE3YYZ repeater local Toronto. Sounds good, John. W F Y.
Is exactly the effect that I'm going to have in the water. 20 feet distance.
This is W-A-2-Z-G-Z listing.